Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 223, Seeking Wisdom in Extreme Solitude. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
Self or no self? The seeming dichotomy seems from an all or nothing thinking. It's actually a sliding scale, a climb. Little by little, I open to the universal ebb and flow. Then it gets too hard, and I shut back down. Then that gets too tight, and I open back up. Cycles of closing and opening, like relationships, like the tides and the seasons, morning head and afternoon head, small mind, big mind. During this year, I've repeatedly resisted giving myself to the freedom of the unknown. And over, I've let go and stepped off the edge, physically opening to the wind, going to the glacier, giving up food, treats, and the cabin's comforts, emotionally giving up email, self-analysis, and thinking about the future, intellectually giving up reading, spiritually giving up the security of Buddhism to just be here alone in the wilderness. My craving for answers is really a longing for security. When I let go of that need and step into the unknown, into the unknowing and trust, I'm much more relaxed and peaceful.
That was the voice of my guest, Dr. Robert Kull. Robert Kull, Ph.D., teaches through an online university and is author of the 2009 book, Solitude, Seeking Wisdom in Extremes. Years after a motorcycle accident left him with one leg, Bob Kull traveled to a remote island in the Patagonia wilderness with supplies to live completely alone for a year. He sought to experience the effects of deep solitude on the body and mind, and to find answers to the spiritual questions that had plagued him his entire life. With only a cat and his thoughts as companions, he wrestled with inner storms while the wild forces of nature raged around him. The physical challenges were immense, but the struggles of mind and spirit pushed him to the limits of human endurance. Dr. Kull has spent years wandering North and South America, working as a scuba instructor, wilderness guide, construction worker, dishwasher, truck driver, bartender, painter, firefighter, and professor. He began undergraduate studies at age 40 and now holds a Ph.D. from the University of British Columbia. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Robert Kull, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thanks, Dave. It's good to be here.
Well, you have a very interesting story to tell, and so I'm really pleased to have this opportunity to speak with you. I've been reading your fascinating book, which is titled Solitude, and which recounts your year-long adventure in the wilds of Patagonia. It's in the form of a journal. Do I understand correctly that you were able to submit this journal as your doctoral dissertation at the University of British Columbia?
Yep, they finally accepted it. There was a little bit of resistance. Well, actually, quite a bit of resistance. It was the format. Is that, as you know, in academic work, normally the umbrella is a conceptual structuring.
Yes.
You have a theoretical notion, and then you present that, and within that you use journal entries or interviews or whatever to flesh out and support the theoretical approach. But the difficulty with that is the longer I was in solitude, the more I realized I knew less and less, and that I wasn't finding the conceptual answers that I thought I was going to go find. And what I was learning was coming to me through my daily living,
mm-hmm.
was arising as much through my body and heart as through the mind. And so as I sat for just about a year in front of my computer, trying to figure out how I was going to do a dissertation. And little by little, I came to realize that the journal had to be the heart of it, because that's where my learning and teaching was set. That was the ground for it. And that was a bit of a struggle to get that to be in the body rather than as a huge appendix that no one would ever read. The other thing that was a problem was just the fundamental structure of the whole field work is to be both the researcher and the subject of my own research. Some people thought that was just a little bit circular, perhaps.
Yeah, I can imagine. You know, hearkening back to my own graduate school experience as both student and later as faculty, I could see where this would have been a really hard idea to sell in the first place. How did you pull that off?
Well, it was patience more than anything.
You wore them down, huh?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Is I basically just wore them down. And coming in as a mature student, I don't think I would have gotten away with it if I was in my 20s.
Mm-hmm. And plus, you were in it's an interdisciplinary degree, right? Initially, I had just kind of assumed that you were a psychologist, but really it was a interdisciplinary program, right?
Yeah, I have undergraduate degrees in psychology and biology, and it was just a whole set of serendipitous movements that brought me to the University of British Columbia. I was actually started out in forestry, and then it was clear that this wasn't going to fly in forestry, so I shifted to interdisciplinary studies. And because it wasn't just the subject matter, exploring the inner world, it was the whole structure of the dissertation is to include poetry and just lyrical writing in general. That whole attempting through the play of words to get across what's kind of not get acrossable in words in some ways. And so my committee I was very careful in choosing a committee. I didn't get any experts. I got only people that I could really talk with that I felt were up for an adventure. And that were just open-minded. They didn't have a set agenda that how the world is, but were willing to explore with me. And
the
default setting was that we're not guaranteeing you a PhD out of this. It sounds like a fascinating project and we'll support you, but we're not going to guarantee a PhD. And there's no funding. You have to fund it yourself. So a lot of it after that was just a matter of leaning against what seemed like solid walls until they sort of dissolved and became doorways.
Hmm. And you were in your 50s, right?
Yeah, I started my PhD when I was my mid-50s. And I started my undergraduate when I was 40. I was teaching scuba diving in the Caribbean. I wiped out on my motorcycle. Some drunk ran over me. And so I ended up in the hospital for a year getting the leg amputated and lost my scuba business decided, well, since I can't walk very well, I'll try the intellectual world, because I dropped out of Berkeley when I was 19 or so. And I just fell in love with academics for a while until I started recognizing how disconnected it was from my own life. It was just theory and abstract notions. And so when I went on to graduate school, my bottom line was I'm not checking myself at the door anymore. That my basic thing was I'm bringing all of me into this process. And so the university is going to have to deal with that.
That's really great. That's one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you. I think showing that kind of courage and authenticity, at midlife is a good example for me and for my listeners.
Well, I just had no choice. It wasn't courage so much. It was just, I just had no choice. It's just what I had to do.
Yeah.
And also, I grew up in a conflicted, born-again Christian family. My mom wasn't, but my dad was. And I always felt disappeared in that situation, that I couldn't be who I felt myself to be. And that's probably one of the reasons I started spending long periods of time alone in the wilderness. And so I've got a hair trigger on that side of things of being denied the possibility of being who I authentically am.
Mm-hmm.
And so in some ways it can be seen that I went overboard in this project of just demanding that I bring all of myself into the process. And I'm not saying that everybody should do that, but I certainly think there should be that opportunity for people that want to do that in the academic world, because the academic world claims in science, whether social or natural, to be studying the universe. And yet there's huge swaths that are denied and rejected as subjects for study in many schools of exploration.
I totally agree, and that's one of the things that's sort of driven my quest in this podcast series, is to present a much broader picture of, well, of psychology, you know, that embraces not only the objective and the scientific, but also subjective explorations.
Absolutely. And that in some ways, you know, there is no pure objectivity. That's a dream. You know, what we call objectivity is a bunch of us have experiences and we compare our experiences. And when we find common ground, we say, well, this must be objective reality. But, you know, how can we ever possibly know that we found objective reality? We have the experience of it, but then our experience changes. You know, we think, oh, this is how the world is, and we're damn sure of it. And then all of a sudden something happens, and we go, oh, the world isn't how I thought it was at all.
Right, and this may in fact play in a bit to the fact that you're a practitioner of Buddhist meditation, I believe.
Yes.
And I'm wondering, how much of a role did that play in your desire for a year of solitude?
It played not so much a role, I don't think, in my desire, but it was an enormously valuable tool in pulling it off. So the drive, the fundamental drive, was when I was 28, I was working as a logger on Vancouver Island and being a macho and doing all that stuff. And something was happening that I just felt that I really needed to spend time with myself, significant time. And I'd spent up to a week by myself, but nothing really long. And so it was one of those times where we feel like a passenger in our own life, that we're almost a spectator watching our life unfold. And I felt carried along as I bought a canoe. I'd never really canoed much, a little bit, but not much, and talked to people where I could go and not see anybody for 3 months, and got food and headed out into the bush of British Columbia. And I almost didn't come back because I really didn't know what I was up to. I had a little bit of inner exploration, but not much, and it had been years previously. And so I was strongly wedded to this kind of macho image of who I thought I was. And after about a month and a half out there, things really started to fall apart. And I was identified with my self-image. And so when that started to crumble, one of the powers of solitude is that, you know, in our culture, as you know, we mirror back to each other the image we project. This is kind of, whether it's a favor or not, it's what we do for each other to help each other hold our personas in place. So you project to me how you want to see yourself, and I support that
in
some ways, and then you do that for me. And that doesn't happen in solitude. You know, nature doesn't do that.
That's right.
And so things start falling apart. This self-image starts to crumble, and to the extent that we're identified with it. And when I say we, I mean me. You know, I'm speaking from what I know as personally, and it seems as though it's probably common, but I don't know. You know, so it's kind of a generalized we, but it's not an insistence that this is how it is. It's a suggestion that this is how it is, because this is how it worked for me.
Yes.
And so this starts falling apart, and there's this real sense of for me of terror, of existential terror, of annihilation, that I was going insane. I was gonna die out there. And whether it was serendipity or grace or whatever, I came through that. There, you know, reached a moment where I had to call out for help, because I thought a bear was going to eat me, and I was just on the edge of just raw panic.
Now, is this during the year, or was this an earlier?
No, this is when I was in my 20s, and this is what pushed me into wanting to go for a year. Because at that point, there was this incredible transformation of consciousness and the sense of just being woven into the universe and not being alien any longer and vulnerable, but that the universe was my home and that just, you know, it was all a flowing whole that I was part of. And that came and went during the next 3 weeks, but there was a sense that someday I'd like to spend a year alone by my, you know, in the wilderness, and that took about 25 years to come to fruition. I did a lot of other things in between.
Well, it's such a rare thing, you know, when we're programmed so deeply to be social creatures. I recently heard that solitary confinement in prisons is now considered to be torture, just because we're so deeply programmed to be social, and that isolation can drive us to madness. You weren't imprisoned, but you were in solitary.
I think there's an enormous difference between choosing solitude and being having it forced on you, just enormous.
Mm-hmm.
It's like being shipwrecked,
yeah,
or choosing to go, sort of a thing. There's no comparison. And if you're fortunate and strong, if you can have solitude forced on you and then choose it, during the process, wonderful, but I don't think very many people have that capacity, because certainly, I mean, and it's also different being locked up in a little concrete cell and being out in the wilderness, because I certainly wasn't alone, and I was surrounded by life.
Yes.
And but there are many, many stories of Hindus and Buddhists that lock themselves up in caves, and somebody brings them food once a day, and they spend years in there, and they've chosen and developed the skills to explore their inner life, their inner world. But if you don't have any notion of that, and all you can, your whole attention is focused on the concrete walls around you and the lack of any input, horrible.
I've always delighted in the story about the Italian psychiatrist Roberto Assagioli, who is known for an approach called psychosynthesis. And the story, as I heard it, was that he got imprisoned by the fascists. They threw him into prison for some number of years, and that his response was, "Oh, I've always been so busy in my psychiatric practice. At last, I have a chance to meditate."
Yeah, no. I when I think of prison and you know what we think of as rubbing shoulders or other parts of our bodies, unfortunately, with some of the inmates in there, I would kind of think like maybe I might prefer solitary. You know, it might be a lot more relaxing than having to deal with all the macho pushing and shoving stuff, psychological and physical, that's going on.
Well, as you suggested, probably depends a lot on how we frame it.
Absolutely. No, it's just like pleasure and pain. You know, the same sensation, we interpret it as pleasure or pain, physical sensation, depending on how we frame it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, one of the things that because I explored this, so there's a lot of pain in this year. And I explored both the difference and the similarities between excitement and fear and pleasure and pain. And I think a huge amount of it is whether we choose it or not, whether we have a sense of efficacy in our choices. So something that's shoved on us and that we don't have any control, we're at the mercy of, is often interpreted as pain, where if it's something we've chosen, the same physiological sensations can be interpreted as intense pleasure.
Therefore, we need to learn to choose what we have, right?
That's exactly right. That's a challenge.
Yeah. Well, let's back up just a little bit. How did you come to choose Patagonia for your year-long adventure?
I had after I graduated from McGill with undergraduate degrees, I applied for and was accepted to go on to graduate school, and I got a scholarship, fellowship, but every place I checked, they were hooked into the neo-Darwinian evolutionary scheme of things. And it was problematic for me because of this first experience in my 20s when the world was no longer a collection of individual organisms competing with each other, but each organism was a manifestation of an underlying unity. And there seemed to be some inherent intelligence in this whole process. It didn't just seem to be random mutation. and natural selection. And so in my undergraduate biology, there was no exploration of that at all. And if you even began to suggest that, you know, you were considered cuckoo and a creationist and et cetera, you know, if there was any kind of intelligence inherent in the universe. Mm. And so when I applied for grad schools, I was accepted, but I couldn't find a place that wasn't locked into that that paradigm. And I thought, I don't want to spend a huge amount of time and effort adding my little block to a structure that doesn't really make sense to me. And so I went traveling for a couple of 3 years, and I ended up, I thought I was going to Mexico for 3 months and ended up gone for a couple of years, and ended up in Tierra del Fuego and came up the Patagonian coast, the Chilean coast, in a ferry. There's a ferry that plies that coast, and I just fell in love with it. It's astonishingly beautiful, and there's nobody there. There's an area from the crest of the Andes out to the ragged edge, the western edge of the archipelago. It's a fractured coastline, like the coast of Alaska or northern British Columbia, and there's just nobody in there. You know, it's 150 miles wide and probably close to 1,000 miles north to south, and there's one little town and occasional boats, fishermen wander through it, and there's no logging or mining and no airplanes. It's just amazing. And I thought, wow, you know, this could be where I come. And during that trip up the coast, these different threads of my life, this desire to spend a year in solitude and go on for a graduate degree, because my original notion was to do an animal behavior study and take myself into the wilderness, because the field work I'd done before, you go out during the day to study an organism and then you come back to the human camp. And I wanted to really embed myself mm-hmm. into the natural, non-human world and bring myself as the researcher into the process. So bring some of the social science understandings of the role of the researcher into the natural science process, because usually in natural science, the researcher is just invisible. There's an assumption of an objective world, and the consciousness of the researcher and the perspective is not really included much.
Yes. So how long did it take you to prepare for your trip?
Well, my life, of course.
Yeah.
Because there was all, apart from the academics, there's all the survival stuff, the need to be able to survive alone in the wilderness, both camping and fishing and building a shelter and repairing stuff and all the internal stuff. And then the actual academic preparation was about 3.5 years, I guess, longer than I expected. And what happened during that time is I realized that this notion of doing a biological animal behavior study, but including myself as the researcher and my own shifts of consciousness, I wasn't up to it, or I lost interest in it, or both. And I decided that the organism I really wanted to study was myself. Mm-hmm. And little by little, I shift. Of course, I lost all my funding when I did that, because, you know, funding is how the academic world keeps researchers in line. And so once I went all wingy on them, you know.
So how long did it take you to gather the materials? Because you did have to build a shelter and you had to be able to get about. How much physical preparation did it take?
Not terribly long. I mean, I made lists for a couple of years. When I'd get totally sick of the academic reading, I'd go look at maps. Because for quite a while, I wasn't sure if I was going to stay up here in British Columbia or go down. It would have been way easier to stay here. But the more I read about the coast of British Columbia, I realized there's a fair amount of traffic. There's a lot of airplanes and boats and mining and logging. And that if I really wanted solitude, if I really wanted to step off the edge and be completely alone for the year, I was going to have to go a lot further away.
Yeah, it's getting harder and harder to find.
It is. Very much harder to find. You have to go into an extreme climate that's real difficult to get to.
Wow.
And so, but I made lists. So, you know, I'd look at maps and then I make lists. And when I finally got around to shopping and organizing the list, I guess there was about 3 or 4 months of active preparation up here. And then once I got down to southern Chile, I shipped a couple of crates of stuff down. And once I got down there, I was in a city down there, almost right at the bottom of South America, Punta Arenas, for another 6 weeks, buying additional stuff. So all my heavy stuff, the food, the lumber, and et cetera, for the shelter, I got all that stuff down there.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you already made reference to the fact that as a result of an accident, you had to have part of a leg amputated. So as if living in the wilderness isn't sufficiently daunting, you were further encumbered by having lost part of one of your legs.
Yeah.
You know, how much trouble did that, I mean, just the thought of going off into the wilderness and being all alone and having that extra burden, I don't know, to me that's pretty a striking part of your story, I must say. How much trouble did the leg end up giving you?
A lot. The leg is one of the fundamental reasons that I wanted to be on the water. Otherwise, you know, it's easier to find solitude if you're willing to go inland someplace. But any place you can drive to, you know, if there's a road, somebody's going to show up. And I just can't carry huge amounts of stuff for long distance anymore. So I needed to be in a place where I could get around by boat. And, mm-hmm. and that's one of the main reasons I chose the coast. The other was the more modulated temperatures, that it doesn't get to 30 below zero on the coast. Although the climate where I was just ferocious, huge wind. It's the windiest place on Earth, and the ocean froze sometimes and rained. It was raw.
Well, it ended up being a much harsher environment than you expected, right?
Oh, yeah. They warned me, but I just didn't. It didn't compute.
It's not know? In your nature to listen to warnings, right?
Right. Right. And the 3 days I came up the coast on the ferry that I mentioned happened to be three of the nice days of the year. And so I had this kind of search image inside of me that it was chilly, but it was blue sky and wonderful, and that's kind of what I expected.
Oh, my goodness.
So, yeah, the problem with the leg, there are a couple of things, is my balance isn't nearly as good as it used to be. And probably even more significant, even though I didn't realize it at the time, I have to wear as light a boot as I can find, because any extra weight at the end of that lever that's the prosthetic leg adds a huge amount of effort. And so the boots I took, the rubber boots, and I didn't realize I was going to be spending virtually all my time in rubber boots because of the wet. They didn't have Vibram soles. And on the rocks, there's microalgae. And so it was incredibly slippery. And I fell several times. And I had previously, several years previously, working as a logger, torn the rotator cuff in my right shoulder. And I re-tore it badly. And then I fell again and tore the one on my left shoulder. And so that was a significant, both of those are significant events in terms of the quality of my experience. There was a lot of physical pain during the first 6 months, because I couldn't stop working to let things heal. I had to be out fishing and getting firewood and finish building my shelter. And every time things would start feeling better, I'd re-injure it. And so that was probably the most significant impact that the prosthetic leg had, that indirect influence of causing a fall and damaging my shoulders again.
Yes, and it was painful to read that part of the journal. Is you know, I felt like I was in some sense on the journey with you, and saw you struggling to kind of meditate away or meditate through or do something to cope with the pain.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was painful to read in that way.
Yeah, it it was intended to be.
Yeah, you succeeded.
Yeah, I mean, I figured if I had to go through this, damn it, the reader's going through it with me.
Yeah.
and it was, you know, as always, a huge amount of the distress of pain is the kind of why me mindset that goes with it, this taking it personally as though the universe is being unfair to me. Mm-hmm. And when I was able to let go of that and really deeply embrace the understanding that pain is inherent in living, there's no way around it. And some of us experience more than others, but our culture, we have this kind of fantasy that somehow we can get away from pain. And it always catches up with us, psychological, spiritual, physical pain, and we try to drug it away. And then we essentially go to sleep on ourselves. We lose consciousness by trying to escape, you know, immediately pain, and then more metaphysically death, you know, the end of our existence. And so for me, a lot of the year was exploring that sense of vulnerability and sense of my own temporariness in the universe, and that doesn't have to be a terrifying experience. If we can let go of our ego in the here and now, and this sense of self-protection, if we can choose to let that go, then the flow of life and death loses a huge amount of its sting, and so does pain.
And you also, in the midst of that, you had to deal with a lot of fear, right? That was sort of at the root of a lot of what you were experiencing.
Yeah, I'm still question the relationship of fear and anxiety. The immediacy of fear is, in some ways, not a problem. It just, you know, something comes up and the adrenaline rushes and we deal with the situation. It's the kind of grinding anxiety of what if that poisons us in our consciousness. And so, yeah, that was a huge part of this. And so, and it's at that level, this sense of having to embrace death, truly at a deep level of recognizing death as an ally. And because, you know, I don't have a lot of interest in kind of Buddhist theology of reincarnation in terms of what happens after we physically die. But certainly reincarnation is active in the here and now, that every moment we have to die to this moment in order to be alive to the next moment. You know, and to the extent we cling to the past in our conceptual notions of how the world is, it takes us out of living in the present and this flow of life, this immediacy of spontaneity of life. And for me, I slip back into that kind of deadish state over and over and over. It's not like having an enlightening experience and then be fixed forever. That's just not been my experience.
A few nights ago, I realized that I had some resistance to doing some more reading in your book. And you know, and as I looked at my resistance, sort of what my conscious thought initially was, oh, there's too much fear in here. You know, this guy is having to deal with all of this fear. And then I kind of confronted myself, you know, and said, well, why is this bothering me? And what it did was it put me in touch with how fearful I am. And that you know, most of the time I'm not in touch with that and I'm not aware of it. I'm reasonably well defended. But at 3 o'clock in the morning, when I wake up in the middle of the night and all my defenses seem to have escaped me, or during some past psychedelic bad trips, when I was totally naked against that fear. So I find in myself that fear, the kind of fear, gnawing anxiety that you're talking about, is somewhere at the root. And maybe it is for all of us. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I just as an aside, I just finished reading a fascinating story of a father and his son, Canadians, that in 1981 or two paddled a canoe from Winnipeg in Canada down the Mississippi River, around the Caribbean, and up the Rio Orinoco, or I can't remember how it's pronounced now.
I think it's Orinoco.
Orinoco, and to the Rio Negro and down the Amazon. It was 12,000 miles. It took him 2 years. And this guy, and it's a journal format, and he talks about their terror of frequent terror of huge seas in the Caribbean and pirates and military guys threatening to murder them. And he doesn't seem to have that second level, at least as it's written about, of feeling fearful of the fear, of feeling bad. Like, I have this notion of being a coward and all tangled up in cowardice, in my own cowardice. And they just, it didn't seem to have that impact on them, that they were definitely troubled by the situation and the fear, but they just, it was just part of what they were doing. And so I thought that was a very interesting thing to read about for me. But in terms of fear, for me, is the whole notion of projection. That's one of the things I discovered in the 3-month retreat in BC, and that I've been working with for years, is that I project my fear. So I have an experience of fear, and it's extremely uncomfortable. And so I project it out that I'm afraid of something external, bears or the wind or other people or whatever situations. And that has the advantage that I can theoretically escape. So if I move myself away from the source that I projected my fear onto, then I don't have to feel afraid anymore. The problem is, of course, it always catches up because we project on something else, and we can't do anything with that. And so part of this year, a major part, was sitting with the fear and not doing anything with it, not trying to confront it, not trying to escape from it, because confronting our fear is just another way of not experiencing it. And so there was a sense of simply allowing myself to experience the fear in and of itself, and not even experience of being afraid of something, but simply experience the fear. And what happened over and over, it's in some ways very parallel to depression, is when I allowed myself to settle into it, not with any feelings of confronting or escaping, simply experiencing, it would open out. This knot of fear or knot of depression would open out into an experience of joy and wonder and lightness. And so in some ways, if in fact, and I don't know that this is so, but, you know, it's kind of an accepted understanding, is that we're afraid of the unknown, that the unknown generates fear. That if we're exploring the sense of aliveness and the sense of spontaneity and living moment by moment, the sense of the spiritual, whether we call it God or absolute consciousness or whatever, that's all mysterious stuff. It's not something we can control or know about or define. And so fear is the gateway to that.
Mm-hmm.
And so instead of something to be pushed away, it's something to be embraced and rejoice in, because it's the gateway through which we can come into contact with the unknowable.
While we're on this spiritual vein here, and it's all a spiritual vein, but something I wanted to explore with you is, I got the impression that you were really hoping for some major spiritual breakthrough as a result of having so much time to meditate. And as I read through the journal entries, I really got a sense that you were burdened by what I'd have to call a sort of Buddhist guilt, that you weren't present enough, that you couldn't meditate all your physical pains and fears away, and so on.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think that in some ways our Western culture is so grounded in this notion of progress. And, enlightenment, the Buddhist enlightenment or whatever religion is, or spiritual practice, has been smuggled into our culture as a process of progress. And that enlightenment is a destination,
mm-hmm.
and that it's a final state, that we reach this final state of enlightenment where non-dual consciousness and we're not caught up in all our comings and goings. And not only that, but so that was my goal. And not only that, but to come to understand how to control that shift into that state of consciousness, so that I could kind of have a button on my arm and push the button, and I would shift into that. And then I could come back and teach other people about it. I mean, I'd certainly read other groovy teachers that had found this answer, and they had this system, and they were coming back, and you could touch the hem of their robe or join their process. And so it was that sense of, the, you know, I will find out how to teach this to others, and that'll be my gift to share with others as well.
Yes.
And it just, that's just not what happened. And so there was a sense of profound disappointment that during the year that I wasn't, that this experience was not living up to my expectations. And then slowly I had to let go of that and just start experiencing things as they were. And then as I did that, things started to change, but not in the way I had expected. That it wasn't, I wasn't finding conceptual answers. I wasn't finding this perfect end state, but rather coming to allow myself to experience what actually was going on with a more open heart. And the recognition that everything comes and goes, that some days it's, you know, just flat and closed down, and other days it's wide open and feeling woven into the universe. And that's just, for me, how it is. And also that, as far as I can tell, there are no 1, 2, 3 steps to make all this happen. You know, the spiritual journey is a personal journey, and it's like learning to dance. You know, nobody can teach you how to dance. Some people like free-form dancing and go their own way. Others can learn the basic steps, but sooner or later, you have to come into relationship with your body and with the music, and allow yourself to experience it on your own. And I think the same with spiritual practice is that each of us has to come into relationship with our own lives. And it's not easy. It's like a kid growing up. You know, there's no shortcuts to growing up in the physical world. And that's my sense in the spiritual world as well. We just have to explore it all and find our way through.
Well, I totally agree. I'd like to give our listeners a window into your writing, into your process. And so I've more or less at random asked you to read one entry from your journal from January 24th, 2002, which was in the last 2 or 3 days, I gather, of the trip. So if you'd read those few paragraphs, I'd really like that.
Okay. January 24th, 2002. I returned at dawn from the island to the north of here. I went at dusk the day before yesterday and slept under a clear sky and a half moon. Last night it clouded over and started to blow. I had no sleeping bag or pad, but did the best I could with a piece of plastic in a rocky nook. Although I usually spend most of my day outside or on the porch, I feel I've become too attached to the security, to the security and comfort of the cabin. So for now, I'm staying outside as much as possible. I didn't come here to live in a cabin in the wilderness, but to join the ebb and flow of nature. The climate, though, is so intense, I've spent more time than planned behind closed door, shutting out cold and cat alike. It sometimes seems I've always been homeless, but this isn't quite so. What I've done is cycle between homelessness and close attachments. When wandering free and easy, I love it and dread being closed in and tied down. Then I reach a point where physical, psychological, emotional comfort and security, no matter how disagreeable they sometimes are, seem very attractive, and I jump into a new relationship, a new job, a new life. I lose all balance and tether myself so tightly that I eventually become restless and break free again. It's as though these are separate world views and personalities. One loves security, my own nest, friends and lovers, peer respect, etc. When in that mode, the thought of wandering homeless and alone, with all the fears and discomforts, frightens me. Yet once I set off, I love being out there, and the comforts and relationships I've left behind lose importance. Then, in some vital way, there isn't any out there. It's all right where I am. I experience the same apparent dichotomy between security of a contained familiar self, no matter how uncomfortable at times, and the longing, fear, and joy of letting go into the mysterious unknown of the flowing now. What I forget over and over is that in surrendering to homelessness, there is the possibility of being at home everywhere. Self or no self, The seeming dichotomy seems from an all-or-nothing thinking. It's actually a sliding scale, a climb. Little by little, I open to the universal ebb and flow. Then it gets too hard, and I shut back down. Then that gets too tight, and I open back up. Cycles of closing and opening, like relationships, like the tides and the seasons, morning head and afternoon head, small mind, big mind. During this year, I've repeatedly resisted giving myself to the freedom of the unknown, and over, I've let go and stepped off the edge, physically opening to the wind, going to the glacier, giving up food, treats, and the cabin's comforts, emotionally giving up email, self-analysis, and thinking about the future, intellectually giving up reading, spiritually giving up the security of Buddhism to just be here alone in the wilderness. My craving for answers is really a longing for security. When I let go of that need and step into the unknown, into the unknowing and trust, I'm much more relaxed and peaceful. Defenselessness is a question I've been struggling with for days. If I stop defending myself, will nature roll over me? I think the problem is seeing myself as a separate thing instead of as a process that's an integral part of nature. Just because I let go of the conceptual idea of who I am doesn't mean I stop caring for myself physically. The actual process of life continues. My immune system continues to function. I wear protective clothing. I'm cautious while walking on slippery rocks and while paddling the kayak. Rather than defending myself against a world I imagine as my enemy, I buffer myself as much or as little as I feel necessary for survival.
Very nice. Thank you for reading that.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Yes, and it really touches on a lot of the themes that we've been talking about. I was struck by morning head and afternoon head. You said, like the tides and seasons, morning head and afternoon head, small mind and big mind. And it reminds me of some long bicycling trips that I took some years ago, and the morning head and afternoon head. In the morning, full of energy and bright optimism, and everything is wonderful, and the open road. And then as the afternoon wears in and comes on and fatigue sets in,
right,
the picture kind of changes. So that's what that suggested for me.
And that's just the opposite of what I experienced.
How so?
You know, over and over, my morning head is small mind, anxieties, feelings of alienation. And then as the day progresses, typically, you know, especially in the wilderness, things open up. And by late evening, often that's when the times of feeling part of the universal flow of the world. And I go to sleep feeling that wonder and aliveness, and wake up the next morning, and it's as though I have to begin the journey all over again.
Oh, that's fascinating. Yes, that's totally.
And so there's this question, what happens when I'm asleep? You know, what's going on in my sleep to bring about this shift? And it's an ongoing and interesting question. Something I just discovered that's kind of neat is I don't typically remember dreams. I've gone through periods of my life where I've seriously worked with dreams, but unless it's a pretty powerful dream, I don't typically remember it. But one of the things I've noticed, just started noticing the last few months, is when I wake up and do remember a dream, and I'm in that kind of half state of half asleep and half awake, I start to adjust my dreams so that I look better in them. I start to spin them.
That's what Freud said we do.
Pardon?
That's what Freud claimed we do.
Okay, I didn't realize he said that.
Well, not in quite that way, but he felt that we dress the dream up, that there was this internal dream sensor, if you will, that kind of dresses up the dream so that we're not overcome by anxiety.
I didn't realize, I hadn't thought about it in terms of Freud and censorship, but one of the things is at first when I caught myself doing this, I kind of thought that it was pretty sleazy, you know, to put spins on things, essentially dishonest, since it hadn't been a very conscious process. But once I recognized it, there was a sense of, oh, maybe it's a way of working with the unconscious of kind of bringing some light down in there. And that brought me to, in terms of finding an answer, finding what I went looking for in the wilderness, is I went for to find a conceptual answer, how to control this shift from small, self-centered, anxiety-based, alienated mind into big mind of feeling woven into the universe and feeling alive and filled with wonder and joy and that the universe is sacred. And I went to try to learn to control that shift. And that didn't happen, but what seemed to happen was in moving back and forth between those states of mind, those styles of consciousness, the boundary between them became more porous. And the poem that there is no path, that we lay down the path and the walking, seemed to be what was happening. It's just as I moved back and forth across this boundary between different states of consciousness, I intuitively learned how to make that happen, even though I can't explain it conceptually and don't even understand it intellectually. It's a kind of a process of surrendering to the world. It's not a matter of control, but surrendering and allowing the world to pick me up and carry me along. And so, and that's what I try to do in the book as well, is invite readers to go with me as I move back and forth in and out of these different states of mind, so readers as well can have that experience with me.
And it really succeeds in that way. It's very raw and it feels very honest to me. Have you been able to hang on to that now that you're back?
Yeah, I think that hanging on to it is exactly the problem.
Yes, I sort of felt that as I was asking the question. I realized
right because it's letting go that is the kind of core of the journey. It's we live our lives hanging on. And whether we're hanging on to physical pleasure or experiences or spiritual experiences, it's that exact thing of hanging on that causes the problem. And it seems to me that that's why we can't control this shift, because the very entity, whether we call it ego or self or whatever, that wants to hang on, that's what we're trying to let go of. That's what's causing the problem. That's what is the core of the knot. That is the knot. And so even when that entity is trying to surrender, trying to let go so that there can be this sense of flowing freedom, it's a catch-22. It's a cosmic catch-22. And so that's the dance of how do we move ourselves into that place of actually surrendering without surrendering so that we can get something, without the surrender being a manipulation. And early on, it was essentially just beating my head against the cosmic wall until I was so exhausted that I let go. You know, there was a moment of kind of a crack in my armor. And now there's less of that. There's more of a relaxation, that boundary line has become more porous for me. But there is a sense of holding on, of clinging, and over is letting go. And the understanding that in some ways many of us treat nature as though it were our church. And we can critique Christians or whoever for thinking that God only lives in church, you know, in this building. They have to go to this special building to find God. And yet we do the same thing with nature, as though cities aren't sacred, as though spirit doesn't live in cities. And I'm, you know, I'm caught up in that as well, that I find a forest more beautiful than a concrete wall. And it's an ongoing challenge for me to try to just allow myself to be wherever I am, and because it's right here and right now that we find what's always been here. You know, we keep looking out there someplace or in the future, but it's coming and becoming still. And it seems to me that it's in allowing myself to become still that I become aware of what's always present. One of the things that we have touched on, but that I think in today's social context, cultural context, that was a major part of what I was doing. It was exploring my relationship with the non-human world, in that there's so many theories and rules and regulations about not destroying our environment, but I think a fundamental thing that we often overlook is the actual direct experience of belonging. That it's like family. If something happens to a family member, we're immediately seriously concerned. If something happens to a stranger, we are intellectually concerned, but generally don't have that same powerful identity. And so a large part of what I was working with was to actually experiencing myself directly as part of the non-human world and explore that. So that also is a big part of the book of our relationship and trying to move ourselves to experience life as sacred so we don't continue to destroy it.
Well, Robert, I think that's probably a wonderful place for us to close, even though I could go on asking you many more questions because I certainly have lots more, but I think this is a good place for us to wrap it up. So,
okay.
Dr. Robert Kull, thanks so much for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, it's been my pleasure. I really enjoyed our conversation. It's been great. So thanks for inviting me on.
I hope you found Dr. Robert Kull's story as fascinating as I did. If you go to his website at www.bobkull.org, that's B-O-B-K-U-L-L, you'll find lots more about his adventure, including a slideshow with a photo of the shelter he built, as well as photos of the natural wonders of the Patagonian wilderness. And among other goodies, there are links to a Canadian National Geographic article he wrote, as well as to the text of his doctoral dissertation. Dr. Kull's book will appeal to those among you who are drawn to solitude, to the wilderness, to adventure, and or to inner exploration. I'm planning to follow this show up with another one on a very closely related theme. As you may know, I also have a part-time career as a market research consultant, and as such, I'm a member of a professional organization known as QRCA, which stands for the Qualitative Research Consultants Association. I recently stepped down as editor-in-chief of their quarterly magazine. I also host a podcast series for that organization. And Dr. Sharon Livingston is one of my QRCA colleagues, and like me, she's also a psychologist. Now, you might recall her from Shrink Wrap Radio episodes, for example, number 190, in which I interviewed her about a special set of tarot cards she developed for research purposes called Iconocards. I also interviewed her on Shrink Wrap Radio number 11, way back near the beginning, on the use of metaphor and story in market research. And then she turned around and interviewed me on Shrink Wrap Radio number 13 about Jungian archetypes and their application in psychotherapy and consumer research. Well, we have another fascinating colleague in our QRCA organization by the name of J.R. Harris. J.R. is a very successful, longtime market researcher and also a longtime adventure traveler who's also a member of New York's prestigious Explorers Club, which one can join only by invitation. All of this is to say that my next podcast will feature my colleague, Sharon Livingston, interviewing J.R. Harris about his solo adventures. I've long wanted to interview J.R. myself, but Sharon did a great job, and so with their permission, I thought I'd go ahead and share that interview with you as a perfect follow-on to today's interview with Robert Kull. I think you'll agree when you hear it.
You want to learn about the inside and what makes us tick? You could find all the answers you need real quick. Get on the couch with Dr. Dave. Leave your worries behind. It'll all be fine. It's Shrink Wrap Radio. It's all in your mind. For insight into personal growth and the inner life, here's Shrink Wrap Radio with Dr. Dave.
Hello, all you dear Shrink Wrap Radio fans. As I announced on the last episode, a listener recommended that I interview an Australian dream worker by the name of Jane Teresa Anderson. And I was unfamiliar with her work, but I went to her website And I see that she has been in the media a lot and evidently has a gift for giving very quick and on-point dream interpretations. If you'd like her to interpret one of your dreams when I interview her, please email me your dream. So far, I've not received any dreams for that upcoming show, and I'm interviewing her, I think, in early December, as I recall. I can tell you that she charges something like $200 on her website for people who submit a dream there. So don't pass up on this exciting and unusual opportunity. Be sure to catch my interview with Dr. Daniel Sonkin on my other series at wisecounselpodcast.com, where you'll also find a written transcript right on the page with the audio interview. Dr. Sonkin is an expert on domestic violence, and he describes his career working with both victims and perpetrators, and how his understanding of domestic violence has been influenced by attachment theory. Let me remind you to visit our new Shrink Wrap Radio store. You'll see a tab for it at the top of the page. Currently, we're offering the Shrink Wrap Radio logo t-shirts and my new CD compilation of 30 interviews related to dreams and depth psychology. You can see the whole list of interviewees on the site, but I can tell you here it includes such notables as Michael Mead, Robert Moss, Charles Tart, Stanley Krippner, Jeremy Taylor, Alan Siegel, Dana Houck, John Beebe, and more. Yes, you could download all these from the site, but it would take you hours to do so. Plus, these are just the interviews and my commentary, no ads, announcements, or listener emails. This would make a wonderful gift for the upcoming holiday season. The cost is just $20 plus shipping, and your CD comes in a beautiful DVD-style case, which will fit nicely on your bookshelf. You can buy this CD using PayPal or a credit card. I've had one taker so far on the Dream CD from a Canadian listener, and I'm looking for more, not necessarily Canadians. What are some other things you'd like to see me offer in the store? As I've mentioned previously, I'm considering a series of hypnotic CDs. Also, it's been suggested that I should provide a short ebook on how to pick a therapist. Are there any other CD compilations that you might be interested in? For example, The Best of Dr. Dave, in which I'd put my top 10 interviews on a CD. Also, I'm thinking maybe I should archive all the past shows, make those available in CD collections, and stop listing them on iTunes. I think it's confusing to have so many links to Shrink Wrap Radio in iTunes. It's hard to distinguish between which ones are archival and which one is the current one. And as I've said before, if I can generate enough income through the store and donations, then I could spare you the affiliate advertising. Please remember to tell your friends, colleagues, and family, and so on about Shrink Wrap Radio, and I really appreciate it when you mention it on your blog, your Facebook, your Twitter, and I seem to be steadily gathering more friends on Twitter. You can follow my tweets at twitter.com/shrinkwrapradio. I thought I would post bits of wisdom, but I seem to be dry on wisdom, but I do announce the as soon as the shows go up. Let me remind you to join our Yahoo discussion group. There's a banner link on our website in the right-hand sidebar, or you can simply send an email to shrinkwrapradio-subscribe@yahoogroups.com. Please contact me if you're interested in being a volunteer transcriber. I'm afraid our transcription activity has fallen off quite a bit. And thanks, as always, to all of you who've made financial donations, and I especially appreciate the people recently who've just renewed their year-long pledges. That provides an important and predictable base, which I greatly appreciate. If you haven't done so yet, please go to Shrink Wrap Radio and click on that big green donate button in the right-hand sidebar. And, of course, I appreciate your patronage of our sponsors and their discount links, which you'll find on the site.
This is Heather Gout from the Naked Soul Podcast, and you are on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Heather Gout. I find Heather's podcast to be unfailingly deep, intelligent, soulful, and inspiring. So I definitely recommend that you add her show to your podcast list if you haven't already done so. I got a very nice email from John, a member of the Seattle Jung Society, who writes, "Hello, Dr. Dave. We, the Seattle Jung Society, just hosted Jerry Rule, who talked about his new book, Living Your Unlived Life. He was very well-spoken, and I thought I had heard him on your show, but he said he'd never heard of it." Oh, more's the pity for him, huh? He goes on to say, "Once I told him about it, he was interested in checking out your site. I thought he'd be a great guest you can contact him at," and he gives me the email address. He says, "I'll give him a heads up that you might be contacting him. His close friend and mentor is Robert Johnson. It would be very cool if after Jerry, maybe you could get Robert on." Hey, that would be very cool. Though from what I hear, he's kind of reclusive. I had a chance to hear Robert Johnson speak once, and yes, he's very, he comes across as very introverted. John goes on to say, also, I have a way you can use your original logo. He's referring to it's not a triptych, it's a fortick, where I had four photos of a treatment of Freud in four panels. He says, "I commissioned someone to draw that picture of Freud. It turned out great, and I'll give it to you, and you can have the guy who made up your original logo use this scan as a basis. Or you can use the drawing of the Jung photograph that I had also commissioned," and he attached both. He says, "This is just my way of saying thanks, and thanks for the soul food you cook up for my psyche." And that's John in Seattle. And John, thanks so much both for mentioning Jerry Rule, who I should contact. I'm glad that I'm reading this now because it kind of fell off my radar screen. So I need to follow up on that. And thank you for the drawings that you sent. I'm pretty happy with my current logo, so I don't know that I'll be moving off of that anytime soon. Here's another email I had written to. This one's from Andy, and I had written to him thanking him for his donation, and he replied, "Hi, Dr. Dave. You're very welcome. It's worth it. Looking forward to even more soul food. Have you had or thought about an episode on evolutionary psychology? Thanks for all your great work. All the best, Andy." Now, there's two in a row that mention soul food. I'm not sure if I planted that idea or if it's synchronistic. Thanks for that suggestion about getting a guest to talk about evolutionary psychology. I believe that Dacher Keltner touched on that to some extent, but we could definitely use some more coverage. And if anybody has a good personality to suggest in relation to that, please let me know. And then we hear from listener Bob, who writes, "Hello, Dr. Dave. I have recently listened to your two latest podcasts and was happy to hear you promote your new store, yay, including the CD of Dream Analysts that you have compiled from your podcasts. But I also regret that Jane Teresa Anderson is not on the CD, and that's because you haven't interviewed her. I had recommended her to you as a guest most recently in correspondence on August 16th of this year, where I summarized info about her for you. I hope you can eventually get to interview her, but I also understand that you have a long list of potential interviewees." Well, you know, it just takes me a while, but I have set up an appointment with her, and it's going to take place sometime in December. He goes on to say, "I have found her a most remarkable dream analyst. Here also is a similarity with your recent interviewee, Lisa Davenport. Jane Teresa has developed a technique she calls dream alchemy, where she uses a kind of guided imagery, as you indicated was pioneered by Lisa, but building on the images found in a dream. I believe that she has been using this technique for many years." I'm not sure that's original. I know of other people who do that as well, which is not to take away from her unique gifts, however. He goes on to say, "Yours is a great show, Dr. Dave. I've just tried to nominate you for the 5th Annual Podcast Awards via the link on your site, but had some trouble. When I click on the education category, nothing happened. I assume this is a problem at my computer, and I will try it again after a reboot." And again, that was from Bob. And Bob, thank you so much for trying to get that nomination in. You may have missed the deadline, because the deadline fell pretty shortly after I put the announcement out here. And as far as I know, they're still going through all the nominations, and then they'll pick the ones that I guess got the most nominations, and then people will be invited to vote on those. So if I end up being in the running, I will definitely let you all know. So I think that better wrap up the email for today. As always, you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. And in addition to emails, you can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails for me on Skype, where I'm ShrinkPod, and you can leave voicemail on our phone at 206-337-0622. I wish more of you would take advantage of that. Thanks to my guest, Dr. Robert Call, for sharing his courageous adventure with extreme solitude. As I mentioned earlier, my next show will be an excellent follow-on to today's interview with my colleague Dr. Sharon Livingston interviewing another one of my colleagues, J.R. Harris, about his solo travel explorations in remote parts of the world. Please stay tuned for some brief sponsor announcements whose discounts could save you some money. Until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind. One of the ways you can support this show is by using our discount codes at GoDaddy.com, the world's largest provider of domain names and web services. I personally use GoDaddy.com, and so I feel good about recommending it to you. Go to our homepage and click on the GoDaddy banner on the right side of the page for info on our money-saving GoDaddy discount codes. I want to thank our sponsor, Budget Car Rentals, for their support of Shrink Wrap Radio. May I suggest that you consider Budget.com for any of your automobile rental needs. Using my special code of SHRINK will get you or your family or friends that you share this information with $30 off weekly rentals or 10% off for other time periods. With Budget, you can rent like a genius.